So, I may have bitten off a bit too much today. There is a lot to cover in my talk today. First and foremost, I want to provide a set of baseline definitions. What do I mean when I say humanist or non-theist? What do I mean when I use the word hope? Secondly, describing the pitfalls of hope. For that section, I will be relying heavily upon the ideas of a few thinkers who have informed my thinking. Third, a personal application. What gives me hope? What gives you hope? I'll be sharing some anecdotes and some reflections from my own life. A definition of hope, which I think will suffice for our purposes today. Hope is a positive feeling or outlook of the future, which motivates an individual to act in a manner consistent with that feeling or outlook. You may notice that under this definition, hope is meaningless if it is divorced from action. The actions I'm alluding to here may be diverse. They can seem big or small and will vary depending upon the situation. The word humanist can be defined in many different ways. For today's talk, let's consider that anyone who is motivated to do good for non-supernatural reasons is a humanist. Some humanists may follow specific ethical guidelines. They may be vegan, utilitarian, libertarian, socialist, Marxist. They could be Unitarians seeking to live by our seven principles that we just read. The question of what should form the basis of a proper humanist ethics is not our focus today. I will say that a large part of what informs my humanism is a commitment to social justice. I agree with civil rights activist and public speaker Danielle Muscato when she says that humanism and social justice activism are inseparable. I do activism because I care about human welfare and meaning and health and happiness. I believe that humans are responsible for our own lives and welfare, and that positive change comes about through human action. That's the definition of humanism. Doing social justice activism is a foundational, integral aspect of being a humanist. End quote. Time for another term. More homework, I know. Non-theist. Non-theist. It's spelled both ways, either with a hyphen or as one word. What is a non-theist? A non-theist is someone who does not hold to a belief in a deity. They don't believe in a god. They may identify as atheist, agnostic, apathetic, apatheist, I've heard that one, secular, humanist, or some other label.
Materialist, right?
Non-theist is an umbrella term for all of those people who do not rely upon a deity in their daily lives and in their spiritual outlook. They may be firmly convinced that there is no God. They may be passionate about that. Or they may simply not care whether or not there is a God. I think I am correct to say that some here would identify with that label of non-theist. And some of you wouldn't. If you are a theist, or someone who believes in a higher supernatural power, or being which governs the universe, I hope that this talk helps you to understand your non-theist friends a little better. Please know that my hope here is not to convert you to my way of understanding the cosmos, but rather to shed a little light for us all as we grapple with these big, fundamental questions. And I think you'll all find something of value in the discussion today. So that's pretty much part one, defining our terms, humanist, non-theist, hope, and of course that's barely scratching the surface of what these mean. But we have to start somewhere with some baseline understanding. So when I defined hope, right, I said it was a positive outlook that leads you to do things to work towards that positive outcome. You hope for something, and that motivates you to do something good in that direction, right? We could give examples all day, little things, big things, right? I hope that the election goes in my favor, so I'm going to vote for a certain candidate. If I don't have any hope that who I'm voting for is going to win, it really lessens my motivation. That's an easy example. Right? You might still go out and vote for a statement or something, but you'd be a lot less likely to get out to the polls. Or you hope that paying your taxes means that the roads are repaired, that the police are protecting your safety, right? If people don't have that hope, that confidence, that expectation, right? They're a lot less happy paying their taxes. They might do it out of fear, but they don't have that positive motivation. Outside of government, you can hope for small things. You can hope that your child does well in school. And so you're going to read to them after school every day. You're going to help them with their math problems. If you lack that motivation, if you lack that hope that they're going to amount to anything, it becomes very difficult to do those simple tasks or to do those big tasks, like to drive them to some event 40 miles away so they can get some more enrichment in their lives, right? You have high hopes for those around you, for those that you interact with. And if you don't have those hopes, then that will often affect you the other way, right? So we all understand this dynamic in our lives. This is what I'm talking about when I talk about hope. It can be big things, it can be small things. And that sounds like a fairly bright, anodyne way to describe hope. It sounds nice, doesn't it? Yeah. So what's the problem? What's the problem with hope? Hope can often be a substitute for grappling with reality. And oftentimes people who say they don't have hope, or that you're being unrealistic to have hope in a certain situation, that's what they're pointing to. Their criticism is, well, you shouldn't hope for that. Your hopes are too high, right? And there's some validity to this criticism. Belief in a better future might mean we downplay bad things in the here and now. And this is especially true for those of us with more cultural and economic privilege. We might not want to hear the complaints of others. We might see their activism and their agitation as threatening. Threatening our comfortable lives, threatening our comfortable existence. We might say that they should just hope that things get better. Things will improve, right? Always a better, always progressing. Don't rush things. That might be our response. Or we might be tempted to have that response. So this is a criticism of hope, that it can lead you to ignore difficulties in the here and now. Real issues. How can we truly have hope from a non-theist perspective is another issue. How can we truly have hope if there isn't something or someone to ensure a good outcome? If there's no higher power in the universe, higher being in the universe, to say that the arc bends towards justice, right? Then how is that going to happen? If it's up to us, we're fallible. We're mere mortals. So this is another criticism of having hope, especially if you come from a non-theistic point of view. And also, how can we have hope when we live in such a cold and uncaring universe? I think that H.G. Wells had a great criticism of some of the peddlers of hope in his time. There was a specific genre of fiction at the time that H.G. Wells was writing in the late 1800s, where someone would travel into the future or they'd visit some faraway country, and that country would be a utopia. Human problems would be solved, right? It would be paradise. Everything would be distributed well. There'd be riches and abundance. People would treat each other kindly. There'd be no violence. These utopian writings were very popular at the turn of the 20th century. And H.G. Wells, when he wrote The Time Machine, he was in part critiquing this type of utopian thinking, that the future is just going to be better and better and better if we just wait for it. So at the end of The Time Machine, there's a great example of this in his novel. The time traveler has just escaped from the Morlocks, those little evil creatures that live underground and are trying to get them. If you've seen the movies or read the book, you understand what I'm talking about. So he's just escaped from the evil Morlocks that live underground, and he rushes to his time machine, and he pulls the lever, and he's in such a hurry that instead of going backwards, back to his time, he ends up going forwards, and he goes into the far, far distant future of Earth, all the way to the very bitter end. And this is a quote from chapter 14 of The Time Machine, when the time machine stops his device. The darkness grew apace. A cold wind began to blow in freshening gusts from the east, and the showering white flakes in the air increased in number. From the edge of the sea came a ripple and whisper. Beyond these lifeless sounds, the world was silent. Silent? It would be hard to convey the stillness of it. All the sounds of man, the bleating of sheep, the cries of birds, the hum of insects, the stir that makes the background of our lives, all that was over. So he gets to the very end of life on Earth, essentially, when the sun is dying out in millions of years in the future. And that was a view he wanted to bring in to the consciousness, to counter these ideas of a future utopia that we're going towards. He says there's a dark side out there. If you have a materialist worldview, if you have a non-theist worldview, you have to face this, he was pointing out. And Wells himself was an atheist. He was a non-theist. So this is the problem, right? Hope can lead us to ignore problems in the present. It might mean that we don't really grapple with our existential situation of we live in a cold, uncaring universe, right? That's maybe a harsh way to characterize it, right? But that is something that you have to grapple with if you don't have a God in the picture, if you don't have an afterlife in the picture, especially. What do you do about that? How can you still have hope under these circumstances? Aren't you just selling something false, right? If you're a humanist and you say, have hope, you know, we can make the world a better place, what are you telling people? Several months ago, I heard a great interview with a former Christian minister. Ryan Bell is his name. And Ryan Bell's kind of got notoriety for doing something he calls a year without God, where he publicly stepped away from his religion as a Seventh-day Adventist, and he said that he was going to try to live for a year as an atheist. It's kind of a silly, you know, stunt he did on his blog, and it got a lot of media attention, but he ended up staying as an atheist at the end of the year, and he said, I no longer believe in my former religion for many reasons that he had considered over the years. When he was a Christian, he was very into social justice activism in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, so he was kind of on the minority there, pushing some of those things. And he still, as an atheist, as a humanist, he still values that type of work of making the world a better place. Fighting for justice, fighting for equality, fighting for a better future. But he talks with a professor, John Gray, who, I don't know John Gray's beliefs, but John Gray has written several books very critical of atheism. He wrote a book called Seven Types of Atheism, and he talks about this idea that atheists often have their own kind of religious belief in a better world. And it might not be based on anything. Or they have this idea of man as some sort of abstract object, right? And so he's very critical of these metaphysical ideas that he sees in creeping into atheism, especially the overly positive ones, right? So they have this long conversation, you know, about 50 minutes long between them, discussing these ideas and his criticisms of humanism. And this is what Ryan Bell, after all this, says at the end, in his kind of notes wrapping up the interview. So again, this is Ryan Bell, not the other professor who was very critical of atheism and humanism. Ryan Bell says, I don't think we need to decide between the optimist and the pessimist. The real challenge of post-theism is to be a realist. Sometimes reality gives us reason to hope, and sometimes it does not. I, like many of you, come from a teleological tradition. Leaving Christianity, I was confronted with the reality that there is no promised land. Then, to my surprise, many secular humanist authors were offering a non-theistic promised land, one created by technology and scientific progress. But as with any utopianism, there is much that must be left out if the narrative is to hold together. Professor Gray is saying that the notion of a secular utopia is a mirage. I desperately want there to be an end to history, and not in the sense of a conclusion, but in the sense of a purpose. I want my life and our collective lives to mean something. I don't want my accomplishments to be washed away like writing in the sand at the beach. I want to believe that the arc of history bends towards justice. I really do. And if God is not bending it, I want to believe that we can bend it. Here's an interesting part at the end. He's being really honest with his feelings, which is why I like this. But if I'm completely honest, I don't believe it. At least I don't believe it's inevitable. That's the end of that section. And Ryan Bell, he goes on to say that this depends on our decisions one day after another, one individual after another, right, to bend that arc of history. So he stays committed to a progressive vision. He stays committed to fighting for a better future. I like this part at the end as well. After this, he says, this is kind of his short take, his short definition of humanism. Humanism is a commitment without promises, without hope of salvation or an afterlife or utopia in this life. A commitment to care for one another and build a safer world insofar as it's within our power to do so. We can be humanists without promises. And that's where I find myself. So like I said, in context there, when he's, that's the end of the quote. In context there, when he's talking about promises, he means the promise that things will always get better. The promise that there will be a utopia waiting for us this generation or next generation or maybe the generation after that, right? That this myth of inevitable progress that H.G. Wells was also criticizing. And this is something that's on the mind of a lot of activists who are motivated by humanism. They're motivated to do good, but they don't have a supernatural force backing that up in their thinking, in their spiritual lives. I also like what he calls himself a social justice instigator. Social justice instigator Sincere Carrabo has to say about this. And he's speaking a lot about, part of what he's talking about here in the quote is race relations. He's a black humanist, so this is something he spends a lot of time on in his activism. He's chosen to put a lot of focus on. He says, I don't think it's possible to fully realize my ambitions for social transformation, at least not in the U.S. I don't consider acknowledging this as being pessimistic. I'm a realist. I may think or dream big, but I'm grounded enough to accept that the legacies of oppression that shape our world and the conditions that perpetuate these legacies are extraordinarily difficult to dismantle. Regardless, the fight is necessary. All of these battles waged and little victories won along the way toward those seemingly unattainable end goals help inch marginalized communities that much closer to a freer tomorrow. This, in and of itself, makes the fight worthwhile. And if you are curious more about these quotes and these sources I'm using, they are listed online right now in my notes for today. So that's Sincere Carrabo. He says he's a realist, he thinks and dreams big, but he says the fight is still necessary, even if you can't get a perfect world out of it. It's meaningful for its own sake, and there is still little victories that can be won along the way, even if the end goal might be unattainable. It's a hard place to be, right? Because we like to gravitate towards extremes. We like to say, well, there's nothing I can do, So I don't have to do anything. I'm freed from my responsibility, right? If there's nothing I can do, if it's just hopeless, then you're free from a lot of that responsibility. On the other hand, there's the view that you could say, well, it's inevitable that we'll win. And that's hard to back up from a humanist, non-theist perspective, right? What are you really offering people to base that on? So finding that realism, that's the challenge here that they're pointing us to. I've just put a lot on your minds, I know. For some of you, these might be some new terms. And I want to give you a moment to reflect on your own. So if you have something to write with, pen or pencil, you can scribble some notes on your order of service right now, or just think quietly in your head. And here's what I want you to think about. Think about one thing that gives you hope right now, here and now in the present. What's one thing that does give you hope? If you want to go beyond that, think about a question you might have for me about some of the ideas I've presented. Maybe you say things a little differently. That's okay. I think we're ready to move on here. Some of you are still writing and thinking, and that's fine. Okay. So, anyone want to share something that gives them hope? And then if you have any questions for me.
Everybody probably can tell us
that. I like that. Thanks for sharing. Just want to move on to, anyone have any questions to clarify any of the things I was talking about in the first part of my message?
Well, I very much like your the way you put it, and especially the quotes that you read, that even if we can't be assured, we still have to try, I mean, basically. But my question is, how do you and I, as agnostic, basically, deal with the question of relativism?
Moral relativism.
Moral.
That's a question for another sermon, I think. But I like where you're going. I like where you're going. For this sermon, I'm assuming that morality is real in some sense, and that you want to do good things. Even if you don't know, the question for this sermon is, do your good things have a final payoff? Do they have some good result that you can trust in? But knowing that there is a good, that would be a whole separate talk, I think. I like that. That reminds me of a quote from one of my favorite superheroes, Vision, in the Marvel Universe. And he says, a thing is not beautiful just because it lasts, right? I think he probably took that from somebody else, I don't know. But quoting, you know, the great sages of our time, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So, moving on here, thank you. I know there's a lot more to say, we'll have to save it for fellowship downstairs. But I want to kind of move on to my own anecdotes that I want to share with you. One thing that gives me hope is the change in LGBTQ acceptance in our society, especially for the youth in our society. And I don't just mean out there somewhere, I mean here, where we live. Since I realized later in life that I was bisexual, I often feel like an outsider to the LGBTQ community. But ironically, in looking back, I see that I had several LGBT friends during my formative years. They were just all in the closet. When we were growing up, homophobic slurs were common in everyday teenage interactions. And I was myself pretty homophobic. When you were a boy in the 7th grade or the 8th grade or any time, growing up, gay was a synonym for stupid. You know, some of you may have had similar slurs in your lifetime, but in my adolescence, that was the slur that was used. The very identity term itself was just tossed out there all the time. Everything was gay. Anything you didn't like, anything negative or bad was gay. And then, so I consider that environment I grew up in, which was in many ways very toxic. There was some progress. There were some people resisting that, of course. But then I look at what is happening in schools today, even in our socially conservative area, because I've been in those schools. I can tell you this firsthand. It's not some professor out there telling you that this is where society is going. And I'm greatly encouraged. I have a lot of hope. There is an openness in the current generation that would have been unimaginable to me when I was growing up. To see how this has accelerated is very interesting. And a lot of this is due to dedicated activism of LGBTQ people and their allies. And it's also due to the explosion of online resources and support networks, which kids and parents can now access. So if you are a parent of a trans child, you have resources you can go to. You have support networks you can go to, even out here in Barron County. If you are a child that's questioning your gender or sexuality, you have resources, you have clubs you can go to. You can find those things, right? You don't have to wait till you're 18 and you can sneak into a gay bar. You don't have to wait till you go off to college, like many of my friends did. And to tie this into some concrete examples, I won't use any names here, of course, but I've been able to see things just even being a student teacher, even being a sub for a short time. I've been able to see some things that have opened my eyes to how the culture has changed. Seeing a trans boy in the 8th grade asked to be called by their preferred name. You know, just that they were willing to ask that of me, a substitute teacher that they didn't know. Hearing kids openly discuss the labels pan, bi, queer, trans, and in a very positive, affirming way. They're able to talk about these terms without shame, without the hesitancy that many adults still have when talking about these things. Seeing queer students organize the Breaking the Silence event in Rice Lake that occurred recently. It was incredibly inspiring, the passion they put into their poetry, into their music, into their recitations of poetry and songs. There was one girl, one of my students, who she wrote and performed an original acoustic song. And I was just blown away by it. It was a very different side of this person that I hadn't seen in class. I'd seen some of the negative side of the bullying, the ostracism from peers, but seeing her find a place where she can be safe, where she can express herself for who she really is, was very inspiring. And I know that in past generations, she might not have had that at her age. So that's a substantive change. Seeing trans and gender nonconforming kids patiently educating their teachers. This is kind of a mixed blessing when kids do this, because I don't think this is something we should necessarily ask of trans kids, that they're the ones who have to educate their teachers. It's a lot to put on a kid when they're still trying to figure themselves out. We do need to re-educate our current teachers to be more inclusive, to be more understanding when it comes to LGBTQ issues and the students that are in their classrooms here in Rice Lake, here in Barron. Maybe where you don't expect them, they're there. And things, like I said, they have substantively changed. This gives me hope, seeing this. Although there's still much work to be done. So again, tempered with the realism, the understanding that this isn't inevitable, it takes work to make this social change happen. So that's something that gives me a lot of hope, and I just wanted to share that with you real briefly. You can, of course, feel free to ask me more details during our fellowship time.